This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The criminal justice system has been Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Joseph Hallinan's beat for almost a decade. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we talk with him about what he's learned about prisons. Hallinan is the author of Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. He says we're living in a prison industrial complex. While crime rates have dropped, the number of prisons continues to grow. He says the boom in prison construction is the result of landmark court decisions, drug laws, greed, and our fear of crime. Hallinan reports we've all but given up on the idea of rehabilitation. He says prisons are not places for rehabilitation. They are sources of revenue. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. The number to call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Joseph Hallinan is the recipient of a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard University. He is a writer for the Wall Street Journal. His book, Going Up the River, is published by Random House. Joseph Hallinan, good afternoon. Welcome.
Celeste, thanks for having me.
Sure. You call yourself a prison buff early in the going in this book. What led to your interest in prisons?
Actually, I guess reporter's interest. I was working in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I had seen small stories coming out of the state of Texas about how many prisons they were building in Texas, and it got me curious, so I flew to Texas and began talking to people there, and one of them was a guy named Jack Kyle, who was a former warden and worked in prisons, and he told me he was alarmed at what he saw. He said it used to be that we couldn't build a prison anywhere because no one wanted them around. But then after the financial crises in Texas in the late 70s and early 80s, he said suddenly everybody wanted them. And that concerned him because it injected an economic element into prison expansion. And he was concerned about that.
Yeah. Well, we saw that same kind of interest in prisons here in Illinois.
Absolutely.
And the news media dubbed it the prison sweepstakes.
Yeah, that's you see that around the country. I know here in Illinois, particularly, I think recently with one prison that was for sexual offenders. Three communities in the lower part of the state were vying for them, just like small towns everywhere around the country. They're good, steady jobs, and a lot of communities want them.
Mm. So over the course of writing this book, how many prisons did you visit?
Somewhere between 15 and 20, I imagine. I haven't actually counted them up, but I'd say somewhere right around there.
Yeah. And of the ones that you visited, what was the best? What was the worst?
Everybody always asks me best and worst.
Yeah.
It's a tough way to pick prisons. I certainly think, overall, I think some of the toughest prisons are in the state of Texas. It's a very tough and very violent prison system there. The one in that I mentioned in the book, the Terrell Unit, was a very tough prison. Four inmates were murdered there in a single year, which I think made it one of the deadliest, if not the deadliest, prison in the country. But California also had some very tough prisons. And in terms of better prisons, I don't think there's any such thing as a good prison, really, but I think the better prisons are in the north or north-central area. The state of Iowa, I think, runs some pretty decent prisons.
Hmm. One of the prisons that I thought was pretty horrific, Wallens Ridge, Virginia.
Wallens Ridge is one of a booming kind of prison known as the Supermax prison, which is an ultra-secure type prison where inmates are generally kept in solitary confinement, generally in areas far away from big cities so people can't visit them. And Wallens Ridge is one of those. It's built down in the very corner of Virginia on top of a mountain. And it's an extremely isolated and intentionally very tough place.
Yeah, and that was the idea of this place, that the inmates were there, were to be exiled.
Yeah, very much. The state was very forward about using the term exile, that they were trying to exile the inmates to a part of the state where virtually no one visits, where virtually no one can visit because there's no public transit, no buses, no planes, no railroads to get you there. And that's been the pattern in Supermaxes. Certainly we've seen that here in Illinois with the Supermax in Tams, which is built in the very bottom of the state of Illinois, as far from Chicago as it is geographically possible to get. And that's been the pattern in California and other places as well.
Yeah, TAMS is in Alexander County, which is the southernmost county in the state of Illinois.
Right, it's right down in the very toe down there, and is as far from Chicago as you can get, in a very remote place.
Yeah. Now, some people would say we owe the drop in crime to the fact that more criminals have been locked up for longer periods of time. What do you think about that argument?
I mean, undoubtedly, there's a certain truth in that. I mean, you put a guy in prison and he doesn't commit a crime in the free world while he's in prison. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But it's not the only reason, and even really ardent pro-prison people acknowledge that. For instance, we've had a very big drop in the 1990s in terms of the handgun production in the United States. There's just simply fewer handguns being sold. And as you may know, there's also a controversial theory being advocated now by a professor at the University of Chicago and others that actually the legalization of abortion had a great deal to do with the drop in the crime rate. A very controversial theory, I'll admit, but one that's gaining credence nevertheless.
How does that theory go?
Their theory, if I can adequately distill it here, is that unwanted children, and they have a definition for what constitutes unwanted, but unwanted children are more prone to become criminals. They cite surveys that show that. And they go from that to say that many of the children who are aborted are, in fact, unwanted children, almost by definition. And therefore, the greater number of abortions leads to fewer unwanted children, which will lead eventually to a drop in the crime rate. That's their theory.
Yeah, I can see how that's controversial.
Oh, yeah, it's a very touchy subject and one that I'm sure will get a lot of rigorous debate, but one that's actually gaining a fair amount of belief.
Yeah. What about the fact that the economy has improved since we saw the beginning of the boom in prison construction?
I think undoubtedly that plays a role, too. I'm not sure how much of a role, 5%, 10%, but clearly the last 10 years have been unprecedentedly good economic times in this country. And generally speaking, a good economy does tend to lower the crime rate. I mean, people who might be induced into a life of crime might find good, stable, honest work instead. That doesn't always hold true, but I think it's certainly a factor.
Yeah. You devote a chapter of Going Up the River to the story of a family from North Carolina, the Groves.
The Groves family.
Would you tell us about them as a way to illustrate the impact of drug laws on who goes to prison and for how long?
Sure. The Groves family was three generations of one family, starting with their great-grandmother, Alva May, and working down all the way down through her children and her children's children, all of whom were confined and are confined in federal prisons in the United States because they were arrested in a drug sting in a small town in North Carolina that involved crack cocaine. And as many of your listeners may know, crack cocaine is punished generally far more severely than any other drug, and particularly powder cocaine. In fact, it takes about 100 times as much powder cocaine to get the same sentence as it does if you deal in crack cocaine. And the whole family, in essence, was rounded up, put in prison for total terms, if you add everybody's term up, of about 200 years. And I went to talk to them, and I went to the town in North Carolina they were from to see how they fared and see how the town fared after their arrest.
Hmm. Now, quite frankly, I would not want to live next door to or down the street from this family.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody would. They would occasionally shoot at each other. There were fights. There were late-night drug selling. This all occurred, by the way, on a dirt road out in a very rural area off cotton fields, just to give your listeners some idea of what we're dealing with here. And I spoke to some of their neighbors. And, no, these were not the best neighbors in the world, but some of them were sentenced to prison for life. And even some of the neighbors felt that a shorter term, as one of them told me, might have got their minds right. And I think there may be some truth in that, both in North Carolina and on a larger national level.
Yeah. You mentioned the discrepancy between being caught and found guilty of possession of crack as opposed to powder cocaine, but also there's another wrinkle in their case that I found very disturbing and I was unaware of before I read your book. And this is, at sentencing, a wrinkle that is called unproved conduct related to an offense.
correct. It's a quirk in the current sentencing procedure that we have in federal courts, that in determining a defendant's sentence after he has been convicted, the judge may take into consideration allegations raised after the conviction that have not been proven regarding the amount of drugs the person dealt. So you could have, for instance, have been charged and convicted of, say, dealing, I'll just pick an arbitrary number, a pound of cocaine. And if during the sentencing portion of your trial, testimony was presented that maybe you actually dealt 2 pounds, then your sentence will actually be set as if you had been convicted of selling the 2 pounds.
What do constitutional scholars have to say about that aspect of the law?
Many federal judges have objected and found it to be inconsistent with our system of justice, but so far as I know, no appeals court has overturned that portion of the law. So as far as I know, that portion of law still passes constitutional muster in this country.
So it has not gone before the Supreme Court?
Not as far as I know. Some of your listeners may follow that particular issue more closely than I, but I don't believe it has.
Yeah. So the matriarch of the Groves family,
Alva Mae.
Yeah, Alva Mae, she's likely to die in prison.
She is. I'm trying to calculate what her age would be right now, in the upper 70s, I'm sure. She will probably likely die in prison. She got a very small sentence reduction, but not very much. Her son, Ricky, will probably die in prison. He's a middle-aged man, and he was sentenced to life in prison with no parole, so he'll die in prison. Depending on how healthy the others are, one or two of them may also die in prison. Others may get out. One has a young daughter who will be grown by the time she gets out. So basically, three generations of this family will either meet their final days in prison or will have basically significant portions of their lives gone by the time they get out.
Mm. You write in the book, Going Up the River, that the reform of federal sentencing laws began with good intentions. Why was reform needed, and what went wrong?
We could talk the whole day on that one. It's an interesting history, though. Basically, back in the early 70s, there was a feeling, particularly among many liberals in Congress, among many black leaders, I believe Jesse Jackson among them, that the sentencing scheme then, in effect, discriminated against blacks because it allowed a lot of judges' discretion in terms of who got sentenced to prison and who got probation. And so they were looking for a system that took that discretion out of the system and, in theory at least, would treat all defendants, regardless of race, much more fairly. The sentencing system we now have in place, as many people know, takes virtually all discretion away from judges, particularly in the federal system, and imposes mandatory sentences or sentences that are predetermined according to a very rigid grid that judges apply. The impact that has had is something I think very few people expected. Black Americans have actually suffered worse under this system, I think, than they did under the previous system. The number of black Americans behind bars has soared, and even the federal government now predicts that one out of every four black men in this country stands a lifetime likelihood of going to prison. So it's had extremely difficult impact on black Americans.
Any way out of the problems caused by the changes in the sentencing laws?
I think there is, and I think just as the first Get Tough laws started on a state level, you're starting to see the retreat from those laws also begin on the state level. Just today, in fact, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal about this fact. California, for instance, has passed a law, Proposition 36, which curtails the punishment for first-time drug offenders and allows some of them to not go to prison, but to get treatment instead. New York State, which is where a lot of this began, also is considering the same kind of provision. So I think you're seeing a little bit of a stepping back from basically 30 years of get tough on drugs and get tough on crime.
Yeah. I wondered, as I was reading your book and thinking about what's going on in the state of Illinois now with the debate over capital punishment, the attention being paid to capital punishment in Illinois, could it lead to a wider examination of this state's entire criminal justice system?
I think so. One of the interesting things about the death penalty in this country is that in many cases it serves as kind of a proxy for our larger feelings about criminals and crime and justice in this country. And generally, if we want to get tough on crime, we don't just get tough on all crime, but we express it through the death penalty, and support for the death penalty goes up markedly. In 1996, for instance, the Gallup survey took a poll and found that 80% of Americans favored life imprisonment for drug dealers. So it was a very draconian era, and now I think you begin to see support for the death penalty start to slide, and I suspect if that continues, you'll see a kind of easing take place throughout the criminal justice system and our approach to other crimes as well.
Is this a pattern that repeats itself over time?
I think it is. There's a certain, if you look back in our history at any rate, there's a certain cycle that takes place. We get very frustrated with crime. We lock them up and throw away the key. That leads to really awful conditions in prisons, usually riots or something like that. Something happens, and then a riot will go on, and people say, oh, gosh, we went too far one way. Let's kind of go back the other way, and we'll try a whole host of rehabilitative things, some of which are kooky. People find out about the kooky things and say, oh, my God, the prisons, it's way too liberal. Let's crack down and go back to the old way. And we do. We tend to kind of repeat that cycle over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Joseph Hallinan is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls. Questions and comments are encouraged. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In my introduction, I mentioned greed as one of the reasons prisons are a booming business in this country today. Who profits from prisons?
Virtually everybody. It's astonishing. If you just think of a prison as a city, whenever a prison opens up, it's as if a new city opens up. And a prison needs all the things a city needs. It needs doctors, it needs lawyers, it needs guys to fix the computer, it needs somebody to sell them food, it needs somebody to make their locks and sell them keys. Everything in the world you can think of a prison needs. And so when a prison opens in a community, obviously they need people to work there, so people go to work as guards. They need TVs in the prison. They need ministers to work in the prison. All sorts of contracting opportunities. One of the easiest and biggest is telephones, in fact. Telephones are a very big business in prisons. AT&T estimates that each year inmates place about $1 billion and collect phone calls. And so the telephone companies like AT&T very much want this business and usually strike contracts with prisons where they agree to split their profits with the prison 50-50. So if an inmate makes a dollar phone call, the prison actually makes 50 cents from that phone call. So even the prison, in a perverse sense, makes money off the inmates.
Hmm. Yeah. And also out there now today, private prisons.
Absolutely. That was one of the big trends in the last 20 years is we had for-profit prison companies, which really had never existed in this country, at least certainly not like the ones we have today, which are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. You can buy stock in them. And they do just what, frankly, Holiday Inn does for hotels. They set up prisons and basically rent out their rooms, the cells, by day to various states that need them, and they make their money at same way a hotel does. $50 a head is basically about what they charge, and they make money if their occupancy rates are sufficiently high enough to cover their costs.
Hmm. How many companies are out there in this business?
It depends on how you count them. There are about a dozen, but the two biggest players who account for well over half of the industry are the Corrections Corporation of America and Wackenhut Corrections Corp. And I think they're somewhere around 60% of the beds they control. So they're the two big players in the industry.
And what kind of money do they make?
Lately, the results have not been very good, particularly Corrections Corporation of America. They've had a number of problems in recent years, most of them stemming after a couple of murders and a kind of a mini riot at one of their facilities in Ohio. And their stock tanked and was trading for under a dollar a share until just a few days ago when they declared a reverse stock split to try to get the stock price back up. Wackenhut has done a little bit better, but right now it's still a fairly tough time with private prison companies.
Oh.
Although you could have, like the dot-coms, if you invested at the right time, you could have made well over 1,000% on your money.
Well, then you had to get out, though.
And that's the way it always is with Wall Street. You got to know when to get in and when to get out.
Do privately operated prisons cost less to run than prisons operated by the state or federal government?
No one's been able to prove that conclusively. In fact, the federal government just came out with a study, I believe, a month or two ago. I don't have it in front of me, but the people who did the study looked at that issue and said if private prisons save anything, it is nowhere near the 20% that they claim to save, but closer to 1%. So the most recent federal system says if they save money, it's 1% over what a government can run a prison for. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is not a very great savings.
Do you think there's a cost to us, to society, when prisons are run for profit?
I do. I suspect that certain entities ought not be run for profit. People could argue about this, but I would say that schools are one of them, and maybe hospitals would be another. Because, as has been pointed out to me by Jack Kyle and others, once you do introduce an economic incentive into the institution, it changes its mission. Because now the warden, for instance, is no longer 100% concerned with turning out a rehabilitated inmate so much as he is concerned about turning out a cheaply incarcerated inmate. And if he is rewarded based on the budget of his prison, well, then that's where his incentives are going to lie. And we see that same issue, I think, with a recent controversy over putting Coke machines in schools. Once you kind of introduce a profit incentive there, pretty soon everybody gets concerned about selling Coke to the kids and not about educating the kids. And I think the same loose principle applies in prisons.
Yeah. You write that most wardens that you talked to don't talk about rehabilitation, the rate of recidivism. They talk about the average daily inmate cost.
Yeah.
Give us some idea how states are cutting costs.
Oh, gosh, there's...
this is really interesting.
Food, frankly, is one of the easy ways they cut. There's a controversial case in Texas stemming right now where the former head of the Texas prisons under Governor Bush, now President Bush, was indicted by the federal government for his role in introducing a food substitute called VitaPro into meat. It's kind of a meat substitute, and you're only supposed to put a little bit in to kind of stretch the meat out and make it cheaper to serve. But he put a ton of it in, or allegedly ordered people put a ton of it in, and actually took a financial stake in the company, or so it is alleged. And so the inmates were basically pumped full of this VitaPro instead of the meat they were supposed to be getting in an attempt to cut their cost. And then he had an alleged financial interest in the company, so he was making money by selling the goods to the prison. So cutting food is one way. There's a whole host of other ways, trying to get inmates to work and make money off their labor to try to cut the cost. There's virtually no end of ways you can try to shave the cost of incarceration.
And confining inmates to their cells for virtually the entire day is also a cost-cutting measure.
Well, you can confine inmates to their cells. And sure enough, even the architecture helps you cut costs because now with certain video cameras and whatnot, you can actually monitor inmates from a remote post. So instead of, say, having five guards circulating around a cell block to keep an eye on inmates, now you can just have one guard watching multiple video camera screens watching inmates. So that's another way they can cut the cost.
Yeah. Also, it seems to me that they can do things, they can have folks on staff to make it look like they're doing something, but in the end, not very effective at all. Let's go back to Wallens Ridge, Virginia, where they have what would appear to be quite an impressive counseling staff.
They do. I mean, one of the they had quite a few psychologists and counselors on staff, allegedly, to treat the inmates. But you say, well, how is this done? And they do what they call cell front counseling, which is a guy is locked in his cell. And unlike Mayberry RFD, where you envision cells with those round bars on which people drag tin cups, most prisons don't have those now. They're solid metal walls is what they are. And so you can't really readily talk to somebody on the other side, except for at Wallens Ridge, there's a tiny slit that runs down the edge of the door, and you are counseled through that slit, somewhat like a confessional, if you can imagine it, except in a prison it's extremely noisy. So to communicate at all, you really have to yell. So the kind of counseling that takes place basically takes place by yelling at each other, counselor to inmate, and it's not very productive, but nevertheless it does pass legal muster, so the prison is considered to offer counseling. Whether in fact that counseling is effective is an entirely other story.
How do people working these jobs feel about the work they do?
It varies, of course, but the ones I talked to, by and large, were quite happy to be at the prisons, even though in some cases it's just an awful job. You can, most guards readily expect to be spit upon, to have food thrown upon them, to have feces and urine thrown upon them. Female guards very frequently are masturbated upon. It's an awful job in that regard. But most of the people I talked to were very glad to have them. They were from small towns where industry had moved out, where if there was a military base, the military base was gone, and there simply wasn't much to choose from. And time after time, I even talked to people who quit public teaching jobs, jobs as high school coaches, high school teachers. They got out of it. They said the prison pays better. They don't have parents call them in the evening, and their students are glad to learn. That's true. I'm not exaggerating that. And it seems remarkable that teachers would think that. But when you consider what they put up with in the free world versus what they have to put up with in prison, you begin to understand maybe it's not so bad working in the prison.
Well,
yeah, it's shocking, but true.
Yeah. Well, I can understand, a teacher finding the experience rewarding. But for a guard, or as we were talking before, the counselors who aren't really counseling because they don't, they can't really do the job that they've been hired to do.
Right.
That would be, for me, that would be just horrible, frustrating.
It's what I thought. And I talked to one guard who's 20 years old with a wife and a baby, and he very much looked forward to the job because he said it was steady work, good benefits. You go in at 8, you get out at 3, there's no take-home work. You know, you leave, or at least you try to leave the job at the office, as it were. I talked to a 57-year-old man who had lived in a trailer with his blind wife for years, and he kind of did day labor and construction work. And he looked at me and he said, "You be 57 years old and try to get health insurance." And so at this stage of his life, when many people are considering retiring, he's starting a whole new career as a prison guard because of the benefits like health insurance. It breaks your heart a little bit to hear people talk that way, but that's what it's like out
there. Well, when a prison comes to a small town or a rural area, what's the effect overall, all these folks going to work in the prison, how does that affect the life of a small town?
It's interesting. I assume it varies with the town, but I went to a couple small towns, particularly in Texas, where this happened, and I found it to be a very transforming event in the town. I mean, number one, you had people like teachers and coaches quit the public system to go work in the prison. I talked to one judge who ran a pawn shop in Texas, and he told me that it was the best time since the boom days of the oil fields. He said people were coming in, pawning goods right and left. I talked to a restaurant owner who had added 75 seats to his restaurant because guards, when they got off shift, would stop by and eat lunch and things like that. But many people were bothered by it. They didn't like the idea that they were now a prison town. They felt maybe it wasn't quite clean work. I mean, the guy who owned the prison shop, for instance, or the pawn shop, I mean, told me that when it got toward the end of the month, guards would come in and pawn their guns in order to buy milk and bread and groceries for their families. And so there was a little bit of edge of desperation, I think, that a lot of people weren't real happy to see.
Yeah. In a small town, often the heart of a community is its schools.
Sure.
But in a community where you've got, for example, in Beeville, Texas, you've got
right.
two prisons, that's got to have a tremendous effect on the social fabric of the community and what brings folks together and what they get excited about and what they talk about.
Sure, it does, and I think that those effects can be lasting. I mean, you then get branded as a prison town. Everybody begins to kind of form their social lives around the prison, and so when and if we ever find out that you don't need that prison the way we found out that we didn't need military bases, you know, a few years ago, and people were to try to close that prison, you're going to have huge political support to keep that prison open. So you kind of build an incentive to keep our prisons open because so many people depend on those prisons for their livelihood, for their social fabric. And quite often you see in older prison communities, these jobs, in essence, get handed down almost literally from father to son, or in many cases, father to daughter. And so you get a real bond to the prison in these communities. They become grafted on.
Hmm. We've got a listener to talk with us this afternoon here on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. It's a big project you undertook, and I'll be interested in reading the book. I have two questions to ask. Could you contrast the way prisons are run or the ethos of the communities, say in the Northeast, such as Vermont or New Hampshire, contrast it to Illinois or to one of the southern states? And secondly, something that has nothing to do with any of this. Was your father Vincent Hallinan?
Yeah, I'll take the second question first. It's very interesting. I just got back from the Bay Area on the West Coast, where Vincent Hallinan is kind of well-known and perhaps infamous in some minds.
Attorney
out there, and depending on what side of the political spectrum you're on, he was either a great guy or not. But the answer is no. I'm no relation to those Hallinans, although I get asked that quite a bit.
Okay, I think it was the current lawyer's father who ran on the Progressive Party president or whatever.
Correct. I believe that.
Yeah, and he was very energetic and an interesting guy.
Sure.
Okay.
But alas, no kin of mine that.
But I mean, the sort of thing you're doing falls into his social perspective in a way, I think.
Probably true.
Yeah, I mean, because interest in people and hardships and the social fabric of a. Well, anyway, could you talk about the first?
Sure.
Part of it, I think it's an interesting thing to think about.
It is. As a general rule, and I say this having been raised in South Carolina, the South has always been a far more punitive place in this country than the North. To this day, southern states have far higher incarceration rates than northern states do. The death penalty is almost exclusively applied in the South and not in the North. And the prisons, generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, are... I don't know if I want to say better places in the North, but probably run with fewer problems than they are in the South. The South tends to remain the heart of prison country in the United States, and that's always been true.
Yeah. Well, has a question of DNA testing and the death penalty occurred? Have you heard discussion of this among people who are working there? Is there any change in this? In Illinois, we've had a very good recent statement from the governor about having a moratorium on the death penalty because of the questions that it raises.
Right.
Have you heard any discussions about that?
Well, obviously, here we do have the moratorium in Illinois, and unfortunately, though, I guess in the federal prison system, we're on the precipice of executing not one but two inmates. A lot of people know about Tim McVeigh.
Yeah, there is another woman, I think.
It's a man, actually.
Oh.
At least if it's the one I'm thinking about, it's a man. Who will be executed, if everything goes as scheduled, just a few days after Timothy McVeigh. So although there may be a moratorium in Illinois, it looks like the federal system is ramping up its execution schedule.
Yeah, but have you discerned any discussion? Has it raised any issues in the southern states especially?
No, not that I've discerned.
No, yeah. Well, okay, I'll listen. I think it's a very interesting discussion you're having. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions and comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Joseph Hallinan, author of Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. From your point of view, what would a good, and I know we're, that's a tricky word, but what would a good, what would a better prison look like?
First, I think there'd be fewer of them, and they'd be less full than they are. I mean, we are now at an all-time record in terms of our prison population, and that's on a per capita basis, not on an absolute number basis. So I think, one, I think they'd look better if there were fewer of them and they were smaller. Two, in many cases, it wouldn't be a bad idea if some of them were more modern. People forget that the so-called big houses in this country, the really famous old prisons like San Quentin, are some cases well over 100 years old and very old and rickety and dangerous places, not just for the inmates, but for the guards and others who work there. And then I think a third thing, this doesn't have to do with prisons directly, but it does indirectly, is if we could just let judges be judges. We took away, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of their discretion. And so I think if we return that discretion, you'd probably find fewer people in prison, but perhaps some who are more deserving of prison staying in there.
What's your assessment of prisons in Illinois?
Oh, boy. kind of all over the map. I mean, Illinois, has, as a lot of folks listening know, has some extremely old prisons in Joliet, for instance, as well as some extremely new ones, and some that try to do a pretty good job. I remember visiting one facility in Dixon in northern Illinois some years ago, and they actually had a visiting room for children. So when families came to visit their inmates, and the inmates here are their fathers usually, they had a little room set aside where the children could play, and it was painted in bright colors and had a little TV set and some books and things like that for the kids. I remember there was even a little place where they could get their picture taken with their father, and it was, you could pay a dollar, I believe it was, to get your picture taken, and it was taken against a backdrop, a fake backdrop of a mountain scene with a brook and snow-capped mountains in the back, so that way the kids could show the picture at school, and no one would know their fathers were in prison, and I was touched by that. But sitting there watching everybody go in, I was also struck by the fact that prison had become a normal experience for many of these people, and then maybe it wasn't a good thing for a little kid to grow up being so comfortable coming to a prison to see his father, because it, you know, it tends to pave the way. Many people do what their fathers have done and mothers have done before them, and if, as a little kid, you want to go see your father in prison, it's not such a great leap to think that maybe you might be, you know, comfortable going there yourself.
Yeah. You mentioned Dixon. That's one of the newer prisons in the state. What about Stateville, Joliet, Menard?
Those are some of the older facilities. In fact, just today I made an appointment to go see Menard, not next week, but the week after that. So maybe after I've been there, I can tell you what I think of that. But certainly some of the older, more infamous facilities like Stateville and Joliet are very tough for the people there to run, because they're just simply so old. There are blind corners. There are just 1,000 decrepit places that make it difficult to run a halfway efficient and safe prison.
Yeah. Illinois has the most gang-dominated prison system in the country.
Mm-hmm.
How many Illinois inmates are gang members?
It depends on whose estimate you take, because obviously if you're in a gang, you don't get to carry a card with your picture on it that says, I belong to a gang. But in the maximum security prisons in this state, the estimates now, I think, run, and these are estimates by the Department of Corrections, at about 90%. 90% of the inmates in the big maximum security institutions are gang-affiliated. If you take the whole prison system, you know, minimum, medium, and maximum, I think the numbers go down to around 50%, maybe slightly more, depending on whose estimates you see. And that's a very unique part, frankly, of Illinois' history.
Why are gangs so strong in this state?
There's a lot of theories, but I think one of the best gets down to an old Supreme Court case called Cooper versus Pate, in which a former inmate by the name of Thomas Cooper filed a lawsuit years ago when the black Muslims were just beginning to perk up in the prison system here. And he alleged that the Muslims were discriminated against on the basis of their religion. And short story is, he eventually won his case, or won most of the points in his case. And that broke the hold of wardens, and it made it very hard for wardens to control groups. And by groups, I mean not only the Muslims, but the groups that followed in their wake, namely gang members. And shortly after the Cooper versus Pate decision, you just saw an explosion of gang membership in Illinois prisons. And they got a toehold here, and they've never been able to stop it ever since.
Yeah, you write about a Department of Corrections spokesman in Illinois who can't imagine this state's prisons without gangs.
That's how sad it is.
Gangs are a fact of life, he says. Does it have to be so?
It doesn't have to be so, but I think most people who deal with prisons say that unless you're willing to take some steps that can be expensive, it's very tough to root out gangs. For instance, if you overcrowd your prisons, people don't think of this connection, but if you overcrowd your prisons, you almost guarantee gangs will get a foothold. Why is that? Well, if you've got three guys in a cell designed for two, guess who's going to call the shot inside the cell? The big, strong guy. And he's going to be the one most likely to be gang-affiliated. And if you're the weak guy in the cell, and the big guy tells you that he wants to have sex with you or he wants you to mule in drugs, if you tell him no, the worst thing he can do to you is kill you. If the warden wants you to do something and you tell the warden no, the worst thing the warden can do is just put you in an administrative segregation cell and lock you up by yourself. So which one are you more likely to listen to, the gang member or the warden? Gang member, clearly. And from that point on, really, the warden loses control of his prison, and the gang begins to take control of the prison. And it gets down to something that basic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned sex in prison. Talk with us, if you will, about the problem of rape in our prisons.
Sure. It's recently gotten some light with, I believe, either Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, I believe, issued a report. And it's quite prevalent. I mean, I spoke to inmates both here in Illinois and to people in Texas and other states. And rape is very much a part of life, particularly in the more heavily secure prisons, the medium and maximum prisons. Weak inmates are routinely forced, coerced to give up sex to stronger inmates, and it's very much a function of the power structure. It's done often in many cases just to prove one inmate is superior to the other. And in the state of Texas, for instance, it was so bad they had testimony in federal court that one inmate sought to have his anus sewn shut because of the attacks in the prison. Other inmates testified that guards would not believe them that they had been raped unless they fought and had the bruises and the cuts and whatnot to show that they tried to fight off their attacker. I think it's a very much a prevalent part of prison life, particularly in the medium and maximum institutions.
Any penalty for those who have been found to have been guilty of rape in prison?
Very little, I think. In fact, even the record-keeping of what constitutes rape in most prison systems is zero or next to zero. In Texas, I believe, the federal court found that over a year, I think, there's something like 150,000 inmates in the state of Texas, and they recorded only six sexual assaults, which the judge in the case found hard to believe that was an accurate count of the number of sexual assaults that went on. So I think they're very rarely counted and very rarely punished. And frankly, you can understand why. If you're a weak inmate, one, you've just been raped, so you're at the bottom of the pecking order. The last thing you really want to do is inform on the guy who raped you, because you could very well die as a result of that. So being raped is bad enough, but it's not as bad as dying. So many inmates just don't say anything and either settle the score on their own later on or just take it and get on with business.
Mm. With our tougher sentencing laws, tough drug laws, the kind of three strikes, you're out kind of legislation. Does that make the situation for inmates' safety more problematic?
It can. It does, I don't think it necessarily has to, but it can, and it does so in this way. If you sentence a guy to life in prison or to a flat term where you're going to serve 5 years if you're on good behavior, bad behavior, or no behavior, basically, an inmate in that situation doesn't have anything to lose. So if he's going to get out in five, or if he's never getting out, he can attack you, rape you, stick a knife in your ribs, and unless you tell on him, there's very little sanction. And even if you do, probably very little harm will come from it.
Is the death penalty at all a detriment, a deterrent, for folks who are in prison, who maybe have been sentenced to life in prison or a very long term with, you know, essentially they're looking at life in prison?
I don't think so, for one reason. Virtually every inmate I've ever talked to never expected to be caught. And for that reason, the penalties for getting caught, I don't think, deter many inmates, because they simply don't expect that it will apply to them. They think they're going to get away with the crime. So whether the penalty for the crime is death or life or 50 years or 10 years is largely irrelevant, because in their mind, they're going to get away with the crime. And so I'd say no.
What an interesting topic.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
Joseph Hallinan has been our guest this afternoon. He is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He lives in Chicago. He is the author of Going Up the River, Travels in a Prison Nation. The book is published by Random House.